This program contains explicit content and subject matter which may be unsuitable for some listeners. Discretion is advised.
You are listening to a Pleasure Podcast. For more from our Sex Podcast Collective, visit pleasurepodcasts.com.
Smart. Sexy. Kinky. Fun.
Welcome to Sex Out Loud with your host, sex educator, author, and filmmaker, Tristan Taramino. It's sex-positive radio like you've never heard before. Tristan talks about sexuality from every angle with leading authors, experts, artists, and icons. From sex education and sexual politics to BDSM and non-monogamy, nothing is off limits. So get ready to open your mind and expand your horizons. This is Sex Out Loud. And now here's your host, Tristan Taramino.
Welcome to Sex Out Loud. Hey, you know, you can call and leave a message, whether it's a comment, it's a question about a recent show, or even a sex advice question, at 323-SEX-8266, 323-SEX. 8266. The theme today is really about forgotten histories. The histories of folks who lived and worked on the margins of society, many of them in brothels, or in burlesque and striptease, a world that was actually back then considered bawdy and dirty and the kind of evil stepsister to glamorous Hollywood. I want to do a word about language. I'm going to use the term sex worker in talking about all the folks in these worlds that we talk about. It's ahistoric in that this term did not exist back then. The people who did the work of sex were called other names. But I'm going to use sex worker because I still feel like the word needs to be heard and used more in order to normalize it and have it replace words that sex workers themselves reject. Let me tell you about today's guest. Liz Goldwyn is an author, filmmaker, and the founder of The Sex Ed. Beginning with her first job as an intern for Planned Parenthood in Los Angeles at age 13, Goldwyn has dedicated much of her life to exploring the depths of human sexuality through her books and films based on original historical research. These works include Goldwyn's HBO documentary, Pretty Things, and her nonfiction book, Pretty Things, The Last Generation of American Burlesque Queens, about American burlesque and the advent of striptease from 1840 to 1960. Goldwyn is also the author of the novel Sporting Guide, set in the world of vice and prostitution in Los Angeles in the 1890s. A passionate advocate of sex education, Goldwyn is committed to providing resources for others to explore sexual wellness and consciousness. Welcome to Sex Out Loud, Liz.
Thank you so much for having me. It's such a pleasure.
So we're going to go in like a reverse order. There's so many things to talk about. We're going to start with The Sporting Guide. It's written kind of like, it sometimes reads like a sort of a secret diary or an underground like pocket guide to the brothels and the madams and the sex workers of those times. And it's filled with stories that are centered around the business of sex, all the women working, clients who, of course, were sometimes high-level politicians. What possessed you to say, I'm going to write this book and it's going to be set in the 1890s? Or is it 1890?
Yeah, 1897. Yeah. I mean, there's so many things I want to talk to you about as well, including I hope we get time to talk about language, which you brought up in the introduction, and recontextualizing and reclaiming language around sex work, which is very important. But I actually was interested in, to use a historical term, prostitution, madams, brothels, from a very early age. I saw this movie called Mayflower Madam, starring Candace Bergen, when I was like 9 years old. The real life Sydney Biddle Barrows, who had come over on the Mayflower and became a very high-profile madam in New York. And I just got fascinated with the profession. And I guess in a way, you know, with the idea that up until 100 years ago, women had such few choices for economic profession. So this just didn't seem to be, for me, from a young age, something with any judgment attached to it. It just, it was what it was, and you could enter into this profession at all different levels. And so I started thinking a lot about madams, like as maybe 9, 10, and then I went to boarding school on the East Coast, and I had all these fantasies about buying the library across the street from the school and turning it into a brothel, and how I would operate a brothel. I felt at the time, from what I had researched, I didn't think that women were paid very fairly who worked in legalized places where they're, you know, where prostitution is legal, like in Nevada. Mm-hmm. I was thinking, oh, I would operate it like a private club. I wouldn't take money from the workers in the house. I would, you know, charge the clients an entry fee. So that's sort of where the germ of the idea and the fascination with the business of sex came from.
Okay, this is an amazing story. Because you were like imagining a kind of worker-owned, Berkeley-esque sex work collective.
A sex work collective, but in my imagination, it was also very glamorous, right? Like,
right,
what
right.
I didn't like about how, what I read about, like, back then, you know, in high school and stuff about these places like Money Ranch, is that you had to buy your wardrobe from the house as well, and it wasn't even chic. So I liked the idea that, you know, I'd have, like, great entertainment, like a private club would offer. You know, I'd have beautiful, you know, I'd have a costume designer on staff that would make all the, like, make the clothes according to what, you know, what suited the person. You know, I kind of operate it like a finishing school / collective / offer education. And, yeah, give people equity.
I love this. And like there would be childcare downstairs or something.
Definitely. And I spoke about this with my family, like when I was in high school. I would very openly speak about this, you know, and it wasn't like something I could do legally, but it was always, I had an active imagination, and I just felt like really impassioned about this subject and about why, as a society, we were shaming people for a choice of work that was often their only choice of work.
Mm-hmm. I just can't imagine your parents. Like it's because all young girls have fantasies, but I don't think they involve these elaborate things. I mean, it's just so amazing. One of the things, this clever kind of tricks about the book is that you begin to read it. When I began to read it, and I don't like to read a lot of press and reviews and stuff before I read a book, right? So I began to read it and I was like, wait, is this a real thing that she found in an archive and dug up and kind of pieced together? Because there are, mixed in with the text, there are these historical photos of Los Angeles in the time, illustrations, handwritten pieces. Some of the characters are real from history. So there's this kind of hybrid to it, which imagines a real place and real people mixed in with, you know, some fiction. It's that part is really amazing.
So yeah, a lot of the characters, and in particular the two madams who are sort of rivals in the story, Pearl Morton and Cora Phillips, they were real. And I kind of pieced together their life and then fictionalized it. So there is supporting evidence in the form of, you know, ephemera, illustrations, maps, a grave rubbing from Cora Phillips that support their half-fictionalized, half-nonfiction stories. And some storylines, what's interesting when you're talking about sex or love or death, that there's really not that many new storylines, right, in these themes. Like, people have been having sex, people have been dying, people have been loving. Humans have more or less been the same since the dawn of time. You know, we just have different language or clothing or technology now. So what I found interesting was I would invent a storyline in my head, and then I go back and, you know, truth is stranger than fiction often. Right. But then some people like Bartolo Ballerino, who's a character in the story, I just became super fascinated by him because he was essentially the crib king of L.A. So he controlled all the low-rent houses of prostitution, which would be owned by a single – they were owned by him, so he was a landlord, but each one would house a single woman working. And they were on the – fronting the railroad tracks, which is, you know, how we have the term red light district, because the railroad workers would hang their lanterns outside these single dwelling rooms when they would be inside, and so hence red light district.
I did not know that about it. And also that's where we get maybe the wrong side of the tracks.
Exactly.
You know, people are often sort of making class distinctions about the wrong side of the tracks. Now, have you seen the show Harlots on Hulu?
I have. I love it. It's great.
Yeah. So this
is so, amazing.
Yeah. So people, if you like Harlots like I do, you will really love this book because it has some of the same great, like well-drawn characters and drama. And I totally agree with you about this. You know, for a while, I was in meetings like pitching a show about porn, a scripted show. And with someone, and we would talk about how basically this is like a hybrid of a workplace drama and a family drama. And they would look at us like we had two fucking heads. But the truth is, once you like strip off this, oh my God, the titillation of sex work, it's like people are talking and fighting and struggling about love, money, their families, their values, like choices that they're making. I mean, it's all the same shit. It's just that like when it's set in a hospital or a fire station, you know, these like Hollywood types will like snap it up. But if it's set in the world of sex work, they're like, oh my God, we can't touch this with a 10-foot pole.
I've been in those Hollywood meetings where I'm the only woman in the room, and I'm told it's the year of the woman. and I'm like, yep. Really? Is it just now that it's the year of the woman? Is it the day of the woman? And then, oh, lucky me. But I've been in those meetings around this book, actually, where I've been told, well, you can't have female heroines who... whose main source of income is through selling sex, which is why seeing Harlots, you know, is so great. Because there is this idea that you can have, you know, violence and sex and nudity in one context, like a Game of Thrones, but you can't have it where it's women being empowered by selling sex.
Right, and where we're sort of openly talking about it. Because I agree that there's tons of explicit sex now, especially on the streaming channels. But if you want to do a show that's primarily, like, says it's about sex, then it's a no-go.
Yeah, and I mean, a lot of the themes in Harlots, for example, a lot of those storylines, like Virgin Auctions, which feature as well in Sporting Guide, you'll find those in every culture, every time period, every language. And, you know, the book itself, as you mentioned, it looks like an erotic diary or also a Bible.
yes, well, the way that it's styled. Yes, yes.
So these sporting guides were actually real things that do exist, you know, everywhere from, you know, 15th century Paris to Hong Kong in the 1950s. And they were like local Zagat's guides.
Amazing. Because if this was in the drawer of your like hotel or boarding house, you would think it was a Bible because the way the book is styled is it's hardback and it's red and it only has words on it, no images. So it's very Bible-like. I love that about it.
And discreet.
Yes, and discreet. But also Harlots is set in London. So there's some very specific cultural stuff going on there. And the thing that really fascinated me as like a newcomer to Los Angeles, to living in LA, was that this is set in LA at a very particular time. And it gave me like a whole window into what LA was really even like in the late 1800s. That part is also fascinating.
Yeah, people don't realize that there was an LA before the movie business, but in the 1890s, Los Angeles had the Fifth Symphony and the Nation. It was not a dusty desert town. You know, we had street lights, we had paved sidewalks. We had the New Age movement was really burgeoning in California at this time too. It was, you know, as though you tipped the country left and all the sort of healers, seekers, occultists, mediums came to California, as well as people seeking a cure for health, that, you know, which we often associate with California now. This was all happening back then. But, you know, Hollywood comes in the late teens, early 20s, and, you know, it pretty much obliterates anything that came before, because it just becomes this worldwide lens on fantasy. So for me, being I'm from California, my grandfather came here and actually made the first movie in Hollywood in 1916 or 1914. I should check my facts. Called The Squaw Man. So it was important to me too, like being part of that history, that I wanted to shine a lens on this city that I love and I think is so interesting, because in LA we don't do a good job of preserving our own history. We're constantly tearing things down, and even our architecture is like a complete mishmash, you know, of all these different styles, Italianate and Moorish and mid-century, like nothing really Tudor.
Yeah.
We don't have like a distinct look as a city.
Right. Okay, we got to take our first commercial break. When we come back, we're going to talk about the world of burlesque, which is the subject of Liz's other book and is equally fascinating, and more about Liz's work. So stay with us. More with Liz Goldwyn when we come back. The Pleasure Chest is ready to celebrate spring. You can get 15% off all G-Spot Vibes April 19th to the 28th online. On Easter Sunday, April 21st, all the stores will have a pleasure egg hunt where customers can find hidden pleasure eggs filled with candy, treats, and delicious discounts. Plus, the Pleasure Ed free sex ed program is full of tasty classes. In Los Angeles, April 3rd, thrilling threesomes. April 11th, Midori's Dirty Fun Rope Tricks. April 17th, Blowjobs and Beyond. In New York, April 16th, All Things Fluid with Tina Horn. And April 17th, Deep Sea Fisting. In Chicago, April 10th, Head of the Class. And April 24th, Basic Bondage and Sensation Play. Check out PleasureChest.com for discounts, events, and much more. Use promo code Tristan to get a free gift with your order. Guess what? I'm welcoming my first cannabis advertiser. I bought this product a while ago, so when they approached me, I was so excited because it's something I actually already had and loved. The company is called 1906, a revolutionary brand of cannabis chocolate edibles. Here's what I love. They're low dose and consistently dosed, plus fast acting. I'm talking like 20 minutes. There are multiple formulas for better sleep, sex, energy, bliss, and relaxation. Here's the amazing part. They are absolutely high quality, delicious chocolates. If you know me, I am a chocolate connoisseur, and these stand above all the others I've tried. Of course, 1906 always encourages health-conscious adults to use them responsibly. They are currently at 200 dispensaries in Colorado, and you can find them at 1906newhighs.com.
You're tuned in to Sex Out Loud with your host, Tristan Taramino. We want to hear from you. If you have a question or comment, please send an email to Tristan@puckerup.com. That's Tristan@puckerup.com. Now back to the show.
Welcome to Sex Out Loud, everyone. Hey, I don't know if you've heard yet, but I'm working on a new book, and it's not what you may think it is. I'm actually working on a family memoir, which is focused on my own coming of age story and woven in with my father's coming of age story. It's a story about growing up, about multi-generational queer experience, because we were both queer, history, love, loss, the meaning of home. And it's a big departure for me. I've wanted to write this for a really long time, but I've been terrified to share this. You probably think of me as a pretty good sharer, maybe an oversharer, right? And I'm like super happy to tell you about why I love butt plugs and how many enemas I've had in the world, but it feels scarier to tell you about my family and my mental health and my innermost thoughts and one of the most significant events of my life, which is that my father died of AIDS in the 1990s. So if you want to support this project, and I hope you do, you can go to my Patreon. It's patreon.com/TristanTaramino. If you become a patron, you're going to get access to all sorts of things that I'm not going to post on social media. You're going to get to see things first. You're going to get to see drafts of chapters and kind of cool perks like shout outs on social media, on this show, personal gifts, and even phone calls with me. So check it out, patreon.com/TristanTaramino. My guest today is Liz Goldwyn. And we were just talking about her book, Sporting Guide. Liz also wrote another book, which I want to get into. Liz, I think of you, now that I've read a lot of stuff of yours, I think of you as kind of like an archaeologist, a digger, a finder of forgotten stories, forgotten people, maps, streets, places, photos. You have a real historian's lens when you write about all this. And I'm wondering if you'll share the story of how you began writing Pretty Things, which is the book about burlesque. It's in the foreword to the book, and I just fell in love with it.
Thank you. I like that description. I feel most comfortable in research libraries, academia, and also with helping in my small way to shine light on people and communities and groups that may have been lost to history because they weren't considered important or valuable at the time. And we're in a massive upheaval at the moment of recontextualizing history and deciding whose stories are worthy of telling. And it really makes us look at sort of everything and, you know, what the fuck? Where's my story? Why don't I see myself reflected? I started getting into burlesque after prostitution and sex work and madams and brothels. A little bit later, teens, around 16, 17 years old, I, you know, like many others, discovered pinup photography, Betty Page, some of the big burlesque queens, Gypsy Rose Lee, and I went to art school in New York City at SVA, and I was a photo major. And I became so obsessed with these pinup photos and looking at these women and thinking that they were empowered sexually in a way that I could never hope to achieve. I didn't see myself that way. And they just seemed so confident and in control. And I wanted some of that for myself. This was 1996 and 97. So there was just starting to be a neo-burlesque movement, but it wasn't, there was no pussycat dolls. It wasn't a common word in contemporary lexicon at that time. So I started collecting burlesque costumes, actually, from flea markets. And at the time, I was working during school at Sotheby's fashion department in New York. And so I had this amazing resources of being connected to a global group of museums and dealers. And so I started researching these burlesque costumes, thinking, oh, there's got to be somewhere in the world where that has an archive, you know, of burlesque queens and their costumes that I could research this. And I found that no one, not one museum worldwide, had done a major survey of this, while a lot of the male performers in burlesque had gone on to other mediums like radio, television, even movies. The women largely did not, with the exception of Gypsy Rose Lee, who became known for her voice. That's what led me into it, was dressing up in these costumes and trying to, you know, go through my own journey of empowerment, and realizing that it was not at all about having the costumes. There was, you know, so much more to it. And then I started writing letters to the women who had, you know, worn the costumes, and because of Sotheby's and, you know, people knew I was interested in this. Anytime, anywhere, someone, you know, would meet a burlesque queen or someone would be close to passing away and want to tell their story, I'd get contacted. So I was just very lucky to be in that situation where, you know, I could collect living stories of people, you know, before they passed. The subjects in the documentary, which I sold to HBO, and the book were all in their 80s. Like maybe the youngest would have been like late 70s when I met them.
I mean, it's amazing that you got to it, like through this costumes, because the costumes were in fact kind of a huge part of the act. I was surprised to learn how much money they spent on their costumes compared to how much money they made, but they had to be custom. They had to be sturdy. They had to be glamorous and clever in terms of the layering effects and how everything would be taken off. I was so struck by this story. You talk about several costume makers who are kind of like on the scene at the time. This one costume maker, Gussie Gross, who was introduced to the world of burlesque by her husband, who was a cop who brought her to a raid of a burlesque show.
Yeah, she got her career because he was like, you gotta make these women some costumes, and because they keep getting raided. And actually, she paid for her house in L.A., which was in Torrance, through the sale of pasties, which she would sell to the Pink Pussycat Lounge in Los Angeles, which was a famous club a little bit later. But yeah, she got her start through her vice squad cop husband. You know, it's so interesting too. Like, I wanted to recontextualize this idea of not only the costumes, because they were very expensive. The women were spending around, in today's currency, around $3,000 per costume, and that costume had as many as 12 pieces that would come off. So this is pre-nightclub stripping. This is pre-topless stripping. This is pre-alcohol being introduced into the world of striptease. This is when burlesque was in a theater with a full orchestra. There was a very big distinction between the audience and the performer. And it wasn't necessarily family entertainment like vaudeville was at the time, but it wasn't far from it. It really wasn't that far from it. And a lot of the male comedians were interchangeable, but the costumes, they were like some of the couture dresses that I had access to via Sotheby's. You know, they were as intricate inside and out.
With like hand-done beading and these amazing fabrics. I mean, that part was really cool. Also, this interplay that comes up several times around like the cops and how cops like came to shows, and if they were in the shows, people would sort of be notified and then the dancers could sort of obey one set of rules. But if there weren't any cops in the audience, they could be a little bit looser with the rules. What do you ultimately think? Like, were the cops, and was the sort of danger of being shut down real on a daily basis for some of these dancers?
For some of them, they were, but it really depended on the dancer themselves. Like Zarita, who I was very close with, she was actually out in the 1930s, but on stage, you know, this big heterosexual icon. And she loved to flash. As in her words, she loved to flash her knish because she said it got your name known more. You know, the more, you know, you sort of played with those rules, the more people talked about you. And she loved that. She liked being the subject of controversy. Whereas someone else, like a Betty Rowland, the Ball of Fire, who was working, you know, who was based out of California, but they all traveled the circuit around the U.S. at that time, she was a bit more conservative. So it really was a personal choice. But yes, the police raids on the theaters were very real. And they had all sorts of rules, like in Canada, certain areas of Canada, you couldn't move while you were touching yourself. You had to remain perfectly still.
Like, you can't take your clothes off without touching yourself.
I know, but you know, like the Ziegfeld Follies, which was sort of highbrow theater in New York City in the teens and the 20s, they had these elaborate mise-en-scenes of nude women. But that was okay as long as they remained motionless. But the second that you started to move and sway your hips, then that became suggestive. And guess who made all these rules? Men.
I mean, it's almost too on the nose as a metaphor. Women, like, you can be in your bodies if you don't move, if you don't take any action, then we're okay with it. But please, please don't be human beings who have agency and can actually move their bodies. It's crazy.
Exactly. It's too suggestive.
Oh my gosh. But I did love that one of the terms that was used sometimes by the club owners and managers and stuff, when they wanted them to get a little racier, they would say, go stronger.
Go, and some dancers would and some wouldn't. And again, that becomes interesting when you have the economics of the medium starting to change and you do have the male comics and the orchestra starting to leave to go onto other avenues, like radio, television, movies, and you have it just be like one strip after another, and then you start to have more pressure from the nightclub owner, from the theater owners, from nightclub owners for dancers to work stronger. So it's really interesting what starts to happen at the tail end of burlesque when it goes into topless dancing, nightclubs, and now what we know as contemporary striptease. And it's interesting too when you some of the burlesque queens, they like the ones who when I interviewed them, they were in their 80s. They would think of themselves as very different from a contemporary stripper. But if you ask someone like, for example, Dita Von Teese, who's one of my closest friends and probably, you know, one of the most well-known contemporary burlesque strippers, she very proudly says, "I'm a stripper," and speaks fondly of her 10 years in the strip clubs. You know, whereas back then, they already felt shamed. Like if you were a burlesque queen in the 30s and 40s, you were not respected by polite society. And even, you know, if you had retired 40 years ago, you still weren't respected.
So they it's like amazing how the culture shifts. It's just amazing how the culture shifts there. Okay, we have to take another break. When we come back, I'm going to tell everyone who my favorite burlesque queen is, and it's not going to surprise you. So stay with us. More with Liz Goldwyn when we get back. Everyone, as you know, anal pleasure holds a spot near and dear to my heart. So let's consider how we're treating our ass across the board, especially when it comes to cleaning it. If you're using dry toilet paper or wet wipes, you're doing it wrong. Switch to Tushy, the modern bidet attachment that cleans all the crap off your butt. It easily attaches to any standard toilet in under 10 minutes and provides a precise stream straight to your butthole. Using a Tushy bidet pre-anal play is nice, and of course, after sex to clean up. Go into every experience feeling fresh and confident, and then wipe it all away at the end. I love the Tushy because it's also affordable. It only starts at $69, everyone's favorite number. So do your ass a favor and wash with Tushy. Go to hellotushy.com and get 10% off your order with the promo code SEXOUTLOUD. Stop wiping and start washing with Tushy. Hi, everyone. It's Tristan. Are you passionate about sex education and want to build your career in the field, but you're not sure how to do it? Or maybe you've begun your journey as a sex educator and you're ready to get serious, streamline your business, and get paid. My Sex Educator Bootcamp training programs, level 1 and 2, are now available online, and they are great for sexuality professionals of all kinds. You'll learn how to develop your vision and mission and communicate them effectively. Discover tools for branding, marketing, networking, media coverage, building your audience, and more. The number one question people ask me is, Tristan, how did you get involved in sex education and how can I? Well, today's the day to find out. Go to sexeducatorbootcamp.com.
You're tuned in to Sex Out Loud with your host, Tristan Taramino. We want to hear from you. If you have a question or comment, please send an email to tristan@puckerup.com. That's tristan@puckerup.com. Now back to the show.
Welcome back to Sex Out Loud. I'm talking today with Liz Goldwyn, who is the author of the book Sporting Guide and the nonfiction book Pretty Things, The Last Generation of American Burlesque Queens. This is a book, Liz, where you went, the reason I had that sort of digging metaphor is you went digging. And you went digging to collect hundreds of photographs, documents, old playbills, costume maker sketches from the time. I mean, it really truly is kind of an archive or a museum all contained in one book, but you took that much further and began hunting for the dancers of the day, which you talked about, and you found many of them and you started correspondence with them and you got to know them. So a, you know, a good chunk of the book is as absolutely these stories, right, about these particular women. And they all have very distinct kind of personalities and brands and how they got into it. Although it did seem like a lot of people got into it by being in the chorus and someone getting sick and then being told they could do like their main number. But that seemed to happen to lots of people. But these stories are so colorful, and I feel like you can hear them. You can hear the voices of these women. And this is history that would be lost. My favorite of all the burlesque dancers is Zorita. Why don't you tell us a little bit about her?
She was pretty amazing. And actually, in the documentary I made, you can literally hear her and see her. And you're just so blown away by how avant-garde she was. Still holds up so much all these years later. To imagine her, you know, on stage in the 1920s or early 1930s in a half man, half woman costume, or stripping with 2 8-foot-long boa constrictors. Those are live boa constrictors, in a number that she did called The Consummation of the Wedding of the Snakes, in which she would literally enact sex with the snake on stage. I mean, can you imagine this in like late 1920s America? Like, my jaw drops. And one time, actually, she was mad at a theater owner who wouldn't paint her dressing room. She called him a Nazi. And so she went out for her finale and she mooned the audience with a hand-drawn swastika on her ass. You know, all of these things you can think of a performance artist doing today, and like it being all over social media. But in that, we're in much more repressive times back then. She was amazing. She ended up in Florida on number of acres that she purchased through stock of General Motors and Otis Elevators. Because if you wanted to go to dinner or lunch with Zorita, that was at least, you know, 50 shares of stock. She used to say, baby needs new shoes, little girls need new shoes. She used to always tell me that a man is out to get the most they want, most they can from you, and give the least in return. So it's your job to turn those tables. And at the time, actually, when I first met her, I was working for a Japanese cosmetic company called Shiseido, and I was working with, throughout most of my career in the corporate world, working with men who are at least 20 years older than me, and really, you know, doing this burlesque research on the side. I was young when I started at 17. I got married quite young at 8, and I met my ex-husband when I was 18. So I was having this strange, like, sexual awakening through these 80 and 90-year-old burlesque queens who were, you know, really passing down some hard-earned knowledge about life, about men, about how to deal in business as a woman.
I mean, so as you said, she was an out lesbian at the time, which was unheard of, especially for someone who is so public. And sometimes she would wear men's clothes, and like she would be discouraged from doing that if she was coming or going from the club, because we had to sort of maintain this illusion of her femme presentation. Mm-hmm. And also she straddled that line. I mean, I love that she sort of, it's not a story of like sort of a broken woman who then had no options and ended up penniless, you know, with pneumonia somewhere, which we hear that story a lot. But she actually kind of, you know, she straddled that line of dancer and sex worker. And again, men paid her for her company and often paid her in stock, which was just, I mean, it's like the most entrepreneurial thing you could ever do.
I mean, she was very smart. She was very smart about how she managed her money. And she was from the get-go. She told me that from the time she was very young, she got propositioned. She couldn't pay a hotel bill in Ohio. And she said she was young and sick and broke, and someone propositioned her, and she thought, you know, I'm never going to be in this position again. She wanted to be able to call those shots and not have to do sex work to take care of herself. She wanted to do it as her choice. Mm-hmm. She was an interesting woman. I mean, she had these books that she wouldn't show me on camera called her dyke books, is what she referred to them as, and they were just amazing. There were just hundreds and hundreds of photographs of all of the women she had bedded, and some of them were very well-known, you know, movie stars in Hollywood in the 20s and 30s. And, it, you know, it rivaled the things that I've heard of, like, legendary Lotharios like a Wilt Chamberlain. And she was, you know, she had this reputation in the burlesque community. Like, people were sort of in awe of her because it was not publicly acceptable to be out at that time. But she did it anyways. And as you said, you know, she would come out of the backstage door and she'd be dressed in a suit. And theater owners would say, you know, you can't come out dressed like this. And she said, you know, when I'm on your stage, I wear 19,000 ruffles. I do my act. And when I come out and I'm on my own time, if you don't like it, kiss this. So she really straddled that, you know, as you said, she straddled a lot of different worlds of, like, she played with gender before it was acceptable to do so.
Now, one of the things, we have a show coming up with sex workers that was taped in front of a live studio audience. It's really amazing. It's coming up next month, everyone. And one thing that people talked about is there's the stigma of working in the sex industry to the outside world. And then within the sex industry, there are also stigma and hierarchy, which some people call the whorearchy, where if you do certain kinds of sex work, you're over here. And if you do this other kind of sex work, you're down here. And so I'm wondering how some of the other famous queens kind of negotiated, because burlesque itself was stigmatized, right? Mm-hmm. And then how they negotiated these kind of lines between I'm a dancer, I don't sell sex, or for those who were doing it on the side. What was that like?
I mean, a lot of them were doing it. Some of them were, I don't want to say all of them were, but some of them were doing it on the side, and it was something that they, you know, with the exception of someone like Zarita, who was very candid about the economics behind it, there was a lot of shame attached to it, and there was a lot of, you know, putting distinctions between, no, what I do is performance, and what she does or what they do is sex work. And I find that, you know, we're in a totally different time period right now where, you know, when I made Pretty Things, when it came out first on HBO in 2005, I got a lot of shit. I got a lot of people, women, telling me that I was anti-feminist, that I was setting the women's movement back 50 years. You know, even my own mom, who I love, bless her, like, it took her a while to be able to reconcile being a feminist and also being embracing of and supporting of sex work and sex workers, you know. And I think there was a lot of, you know, again, with the burlesque queens in this era, there was a lot of internalized shame around this and around being labeled a sex worker.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. No, that definitely comes through. And in fact, there's one queen, I don't remember her name, but there's one who was like super kind of prude. And like her whole image was kind of like very, very good girl.
Well, yeah, but you know, I mean, that again goes like Gypsy Rose Lee, who's one of the most famous. Like, she had a whole troupe of women, and she had them be different versions of male fantasies. Like, you know, there was the devil, who, you know, and there was the Virginal Eve and the Southern Belle, and, you know, so you're existing within the framework of, you know, mm-hmm. but through a patriarchal lens of what is sexy, right?
Right.
So you're still like they're performing and existing within these specific confines.
Because the paying clientele is mostly men.
The paying clientele is mostly men, although during the daytime shows, there were a lot of women that would go. I mean, women did go see, they went to go see burlesque with their partner, but they also went solo because they wanted to see what clothes the burlesque queens were wearing. You know, they were fashion icons that were coming through small towns that didn't have access to, like, high fashion. So a lot of women would write letters to the queens wanting to, you know, borrow their costumes or know how to emulate a look, or, you know, some of the same things that I, you know, 60 years later wanted to know from them. Like, how can I be a tenth as confident, as powerful, as sexually liberated as you.
Mm-hmm. And it's a question that really does persist. We're going to take another commercial break. When we come back, we're going to talk about what Liz is doing now, which is very current and is still in the field of sexuality. So I can't wait to hear about that. Let's take a break, hear from our great sponsors, including the Pleasure Chest, who makes this show possible. And when we come back, more with Liz Goldwyn. The Pleasure Chest is ready to celebrate spring. You can get 15% off all G-Spot Vibes April 19th to the 28th online. On Easter Sunday, April 21st, all the stores will have a pleasure egg hunt where customers can find hidden pleasure eggs filled with candy, treats, and delicious discounts. Plus, the Pleasure Ed free sex ed program is full of tasty classes. In Los Angeles, April 3rd, thrilling threesomes. April 11th, Midori's Dirty Fun Rope Tricks. April 17th, Blowjobs and Beyond. In New York, April 16th, All Things Fluid with Tina Horn. And April 17th, Deep Sea Fisting. In Chicago, April 10th, Head of the Class. And April 24th, Basic Bondage and Sensation Play. Check out PleasureChest.com for discounts, events, and much more. Use promo code Tristan to get a free gift with your order. Tasty Hole. It's the world's first flavored butthole scrub to enhance the rimming experience. It gently exfoliates the external part of the anus and flavors it. Think glazed donut hole, peach ring, hot vanilla latte, and cherry gobbler. When I first heard about this product, it did seem like a novelty, but I think it's the perfect gateway for beginning rimmers. It encourages you to dive in and eat some ass. And anything that does that is awesome in my book. Find it at tastyholescrub.com. Use code Tristan for $10 off your order. That's tastyholescrub.com.
You're tuned in to Sex Out Loud with your host, Tristan Taramino. We want to hear from you. If you have a question or comment, please send an email to Tristan@puckerup.com. That's Tristan@puckerup.com. Now back to the show.
Welcome back to Sex Out Loud, everyone. My guest today is filmmaker, author, really cool person who I want to have coffee with, Liz Goldwyn. And so at the top of the show, I talked about language. I kind of went back and forth about how to refer to people, because there's both this historic piece and then there's how I want to sort of respect sex workers of today. So I kind of went back and forth on that. And I know you wanted to comment on that.
I do. And, I think, one of the things that I'm doing with my new platform, which is the Sex Ed, is bringing these conversations to light. You mentioned me being a historian, and that's not, or a researcher, and that's not only of the past, but it's of the present, right? Because I feel very lucky and grateful to have spent now over 20 years in studying and researching the fields of sexuality. But not everyone has. And not everyone has access to information, has access to changing nomenclature. And I think that, we have a responsibility to educate people. There is a big deal. We have a podcast, The Sex Ed, that I host called The Sex Ed. And on our first episode of season one, it was an interview I did with a third generation sex worker called Catherine Clay, who refers to herself as a prostitute. She's in her late 40s, that her grandmother was a prostitute, her mother was a prostitute, then that's how they identify. And to her, the term sex worker is new. And she herself carries a lot of shame about being labeled a prostitute. So I think, even that idea that there's new nomenclature around that labor, is for someone who's been in that labor is like a relatively new idea. So I think it's like we're at this great point right now where we have a possibility to change the dialogue and to reframe these ideas, to reframe what we think of as the labor of sex.
And so you did all this work, and then this brings you to creating a platform. It's not just a podcast, it's also a website. What do you feel like is the most pressing issue right now? I mean, we've talked a million times on the show about how sex education is failing our young people and abstinence-only sex education sucks and people still don't know how their own bodies work. What do you feel like in the mission of the sex ed, like you, we urgently need to address?
I think, I mean, I actually got the idea for the sex ed when I was a teen, 13 and working at Planned Parenthood in Los Angeles in the clinic in Santa Monica, answering phones and organizing media library and answering questions from people who came in to check out material that were way beyond my personal experience. And because of that, and then my through line in my life, my career, books, films, I have de facto been that person for other people to feel comfortable around to ask these questions and to basically, most of us want to hear we're normal, right? Mm-hmm. What we're mm-hmm. experiencing, what we're feeling is normal. We're not alone. We're human. There's as long as it's between consenting adults, as long as we're not hurting ourselves or hurting someone else, it's okay. It's all right, and that there's probably someone else out there on the planet that is experiencing these same insecurities, frustrations, trauma, vulnerabilities as we are. So, I don't think, unfortunately, in our lifetime that we're going to see a time where we have comprehensive global sex education where it should be, in schools. That's not going to happen. I think that is the great democratization of the internet, right, is to provide spaces where people can anonymously access information. So, I mean, it's hard to choose just what is the one, what is the primary, because there's so many things to attack. And I think that it's so great that there are so many people like yourself, Erica Chitty Cohen, who has Loom in Los Angeles, like Andrea Berica, who has O School, like Cindy Gallup, who has Make Love Not Porn, like the folks behind Afrosexology. It's so amazing that there's so many of us right now in this space talking about these issues, because no single one of us can conquer the whole issue of like the global population's lack of comprehensive sex education.
No, you're totally right. And so when people come to the platform, what are some of the things that people want to talk most about?
We get DMs and emails every single day, and a lot of it is coming from that place of am I normal? I'm worried that my vulva isn't normal, that I have too small of a vulva, and that's why I'm still a virgin. I'm worried that I'm an aberration because everywhere I look online, it says you're supposed to feel pleasure from your prostate, and I don't feel pleasure. I don't feel attractive. I haven't felt attractive in 3 years. It's a lot of the same in different guises, questions that have been asked since I was 13. Mm-hmm. It's creating a space to have these conversations and have them openly like you and I are now, and have them outside of just the sex positive community. I think that's where really my mission comes in, is that a lot of people, they're not, that because of their religious or cultural upbringing, or, they have an association with sex. They're like, well, I've never been to a sex toy store. I've never been to the pleasure chest. I would never use a sex toy. So, like, how do you meet people where they're at? How do you provide information for people in a way that's digestible? So you're not like necessarily going into a community guns blazing with an agenda where you haven't laid the groundwork. Mm-hmm. So like on our new season of the podcast, for example, we've got, we're sex, health, and consciousness. So we bring a lot of dialogue around spirituality and religion into it, because a lot of people, I think, are raised with more conservative belief systems, but that doesn't mean that they don't have a right to explore their sexuality. So what's that way in, and what's that language about?
Yeah, I mean, I think this is one of the most under-discussed things, which is sex and religion and spirituality. And there are many reasons for this, right? Especially with Catholic and Christian religions, which are really anti-sex and anti-pleasure and anti-queer and anti, control of your own body, et cetera. So I think that is like an area where we still have like sort of so much to grow and learn. Like I always have these fantasies about sex education happening in churches. Like what if as part of the programming that they provided to their community, it was like, we're going to have a bake sale and we're going to have Sunday school. And we're also going to have like sex ed for adults. That would be so amazing.
Well, actually, I mean, there's versions of that. We had on the first season of the podcast, we had Gwen McClendon, who's a minister and has also been a sex educator since 1969. So even though in her particular house of worship, the doctrine is that sex is between a man and a woman and there's no sex before marriage, she's been working with teenagers since 1969. So she just knows that it's not realistic. And she also doesn't want anyone to come into her house of God and feel unwelcome, meaning if the way they express love is you know, with being partnered with someone the same sex, then God loves you. God loves you. So there's a lot of gray areas within this. We have a lot of sex positive Christian members of our community, and even of like the actual sex ed team. We also, on our new season coming up, we have a woman who's a Muslim sex educator within more conservative Muslim communities. I think personally that the intersection of spirituality and sexuality needs to be explored. When you go into a bookstore, the books that are about sexuality and books about spirituality are separated. But if we're going to look at an integrated, holistic view of sex, that does include our spiritual life, right? Whether that's, mm-hmm. You know, organized religion or whether that's, you know, more esoteric practices like tantra, for example, orgasm breathing or yoga or mindfulness. We throw around this word mindfulness and wellness and thinking about what you eat all the time. But why aren't we talking about our bodies as, you know, and sex as being sexual energy, life force energy?
Absolutely. Well, thank you so much for being on the show, Liz. This was a great conversation. I want people to know how to find you. The platform is called The Sex Ed, and it's at thesexed.com. Liz is on Twitter and Instagram as Goldilocks LG, GoldilocksLG. And The Sex Ed is on Twitter and Instagram at The Sex Ed. I want to thank everyone who makes this show possible. Executive producer Karen Dana, senior producer Raymond Johnson, announcer Cooper Beckett from Life on the Swing Set, A-Rod, my engineer, Josh on the board today, everyone at Voice America. Tune in next Friday, 5 p.m. Pacific, 8 p.m. Eastern for another edition of the show. You can catch me on social media across all platforms. I'm Tristan Taramino. And take some time to talk about sex out loud.
That's a wrap on today's show. Go to voiceamerica.com to listen to this and other episodes on demand or as podcasts. And make sure you come back next Friday night at 8 p.m. Eastern, 5 Pacific, for Sex Out Loud with Tristan Taramino on Voice America Variety.